Blog Talk Radio.
Lawsuit today, which made me when I first saw that headline that it meant the fight with Mayweather is creeping towards more of a possibility, but then I read the full story. And he settled with Oscar De La Hoya and Richard Schaefer. So
yeah,
he's just letting the promoters out of the deal, I guess. So he's still going on against Floyd Mayweather Jr. and his father and uncle.
Yeah, Beavis and Butthead, you mean?
But no, the Three Stooges. Three of them.
That's good. Which one's which stooge?
I didn't watch those guys enough to compare. But also, on the same front, there's some other steroid whisperings going on. Power pellet news, I guess you could call it. I'm sure you remember back in April when Andre Berto lost to Victor Ortiz, right?
Of course. It was a very good fight.
Well, since Twitter's making the news so much lately, Berto had to jump into the fray there. And he says on Twitter, there is a reason why Ortiz had so much energy, a reason he could take my heavy shots and keep ticking. And there is a reason why he came into the ring 165 pounds. I know people close to him in his camp, and I know exactly what he was taking. It wasn't Flintstone vitamins, but it is what it is.
Oh.
It is what it is. I should have beat him anyways, but it wasn't me that night. Ortiz wasn't him either.
Yeah, Walter, I don't know. I mean, who Ortiz was, but I'll tell you, Berto looked like crap. You know, it's like they're going by the first round. By the first round, he was, you know, in the corner, and his legs are gone. That's the way to talk on his own.
Yeah.
So don't be making excuses. You want to make excuses to get the hell out of the ball. Really. And that's all well and good.
Well, also, his buddy Andre Durrell chimed in and said, I know what he was taking, too. So, apparently there's some kind of drug circulating in the boxing world where it doesn't show up in tests, or these guys are just making stuff up. Who knows? But it's kind of interesting.
I'll go with Action B on that one.
Whether it's got anything to do with what Floyd thinks Manny's taken and his whole family thinks Manny's taken, we don't know. But we also have some musical boxing news, if you can believe it.
Okay.
The Rocky series is going to be turned into a musical.
I heard that. I shook my head.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, the soundtrack is obviously pretty popular.
Well, I mean,
work out to it all over the place. So.
Very true. There's a cop car down my street.
Uh-oh. You do.
I didn't do anything.
Well, gonna fly soon is the topic of the article.
All right, now I'm in the office.
No, I can sit down and think.
All right, here it is. Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, a Tony Award-winning songwriting team, who, along with the book writer Thomas Meehan, are deep into a stage musical adaptation of the boxing romantic drama Rocky, the winner of the 1976 Academy Award for Best Picture. And the creators and producers include Sylvester Stallone. Maybe they ought to take away his nomination to the Hall of Fame for this. They held the private reading of the work in New York in April, and they described the reading as creatively successful and said work was continuing toward the goal of mounting the musical in Germany in the fall of 2012. and then maybe they hope to bring Rocky to Broadway in the spring of 2013.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, we'll see if that happens. And other musical news, your boy from Philly, Joe Frazier, is trying to revive his musical career at 67 years old.
Really?
Reviving the R&B group The Knockouts, which he pursued even in the prime of his boxing days. He actually played the Caesars Palace Lounge in 1970 before any of his fights with Muhammad Ali. And he sold his Philadelphia gym 2 years ago, and he'll pick up the microphones Friday through June 12th as the special guest of Harmic, the Tom Jones impersonator, who plans to model his review after Jones's TV variety show from 1969. Now, I'm assuming this has got to be in Vegas, but it doesn't say. Whatever Harmic's playing, I guess that's where Frazier plans to play. So, it's kind of interesting. But music was a timekeeper for me, is what Frazier says. When I went to the gym on days when everyone was gone besides me, I'd play my 45s, put about six or seven of them on. Timing his burst of training to a three-minute single was the secret to why he could work out the whole three-minute round. And his secret weapon, the bells. Yeah, he says, you never know where the time goes. Maybe getting closer to the graveyard. But the good Lord's been good to me over the years, and I'm still walking, I'm still talking, I'm still singing, and I'm still having fun. And, of course, we have some MMA news. We had UFC 130 this last weekend with the main event being Rampage Jackson and Matt Hamill. It was sort of a dental fight. Matt Hamill was relying on his wrestling a little too heavily. Didn't get anywhere. Couldn't take Rampage down. Rampage is obviously the better striker, but he didn't really have to work that hard to win and prevent those takedowns. And also, we had a co-main event, which was very, very, very dull, and brought to light the fact that Roy Nelson isn't in the best of physical shape. And the second straight rough performance, he had a really tough fight against the Ultimate Fighter coach for last season, Junior Dos Santos. In his last fight, and this fight was three rounds against a guy he knows pretty well, Frank Mir. And Mir hit him with everything in the kitchen sink. And Roy had a nice right hand scattered through the three rounds, but just didn't look good at all. He was gassed. He is notorious for being a very independent guy. Just doesn't have a coaching staff. He actually had Dan Hardy in his corner, who almost lost his last few fights, three to be exact. So that's kind of weird. And he blamed Dan Hardy after the fight for the loss itself. So that's kind of funny.
Well, let me ask you a question. I didn't call hard, you know, last Saturday I was at a all-day party. I remember about maybe 2 years ago when Floyd Mayweather came out of China was going to play Juan Manuel Marquez. And Dana White was ripping, you know, the Mayweather-Marquez fight because he was hosting the fight card. Like the same night or the same weekend or around the same time. And he's like, "Fine, man, I wonder if that's going to be one dull fight. Mayweather's going to be dancing with the stars and he's going to do that. But order my card and you'll get seven great fights." He just told me the two main events were dull. So does that basically shoot Dan away right in the ass saying that every one of his cards is quote-unquote great and every fight is quote-unquote great?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, not all of them.
I don't think your ego will let him admit one of his
cards. Well, this one was supposed to have better main event. Unfortunately, there were some injuries to Greg Maynard and Frankie Edgar, who put on a hell of a fight the last time they got into the octagon. So whatever happened, that was a shame because that could have saved the whole card. There were a couple other good fights on there. There's a great knockout. I forget the guy's name, but I'll get to it in a second. The guy who lost the fight was Stefan Struve, who is 6'11", I think. Tall guy.
Wow.
Tall. And he lost to a guy who was 6'4". So it was a couple tall guys. And both of them were tall enough so that their heads, like, went above the wall of the octagon. And at one point, I think one guy got caution for holding the top of the octagon. But it was sort of a surprise win. The guy who won the fight knocked Stefan Struve straight on his ass with some vicious punches. Looked like he was out cold. And then the ref called the fight. We also had a pretty good conference call today on the Ultimate Fighter finale. Number 13 for the 13 seasons that they've done it. And I didn't catch this when it first came out. It might have been a few weeks ago or within the last couple of weeks. But apparently the next season is going to feature Jason Mayhem Miller versus Michael Bisping as the coaches. You know, I don't know what weight division they're going to have, but those are the two coaches. And for the life of me, I can't figure out why they've been harping on Michael Bisping. He's been in the mix for a while. I've always heard Dana White trying to match him up with somebody in the candidates. And I don't understand. I mean, he hasn't had a great fight in a long time, I don't think. And his last fight was against Jorge Rivera. There was a lot of controversy because he spit on Jorge Rivera's coach. So I don't see what the point of rewarding a guy like that is. And they were also trying to get Chael Sonnen, the testosterone user there, to be his opponent for a long time. So it's just for the life of me, I can't figure out what the heck they're thinking there. And, of course, the show itself is notorious for encouraging bad behavior, I guess, by letting these guys drink in the house and promoting all sorts of junk. It's interesting because today on the conference call, Clay Guida had attended a taping or a trial, and I forget for what season it was, but they were asking him some questions about that. And he mentioned that it seems to him like a lot of times they don't go for the fighter. They go for the guy who's going to create the most drama in the house. And this season, I particularly noticed that we had a few guys that got to the finals or the semifinals there, and they didn't do so hot, but usually, there's one or two guys that end up with a fight on the finale card. And maybe, for whatever reason, they just haven't been listed yet, and they will be on the card just because the show just ended so soon. Between the end and the card, they haven't listed them yet. But I thought it was really weird that this year they didn't list a single fighter other than the two main event guys as going to the next level just to give them a shot to see if they've improved since the end of the taping of the show. But not a single one. There's, of course, the two winners of the show, Tony Ferguson and Ramsey Nijem, are going to be fighting each other. And Ferguson was the one I talked about last week who flipped out in the house and was going after the other guy, calling out, you know, his kid for whatever reason. And he's still apologizing. He was apologizing on the conference call. The main event this weekend at the Palms Casino in Las Vegas, June 4th to Saturday, is going to be Anthony Pettis versus Cody Guida. It's like one of those fights made possible by the WEC and UFC merger. And Anthony Pettis is pretty much waiting for the fight I mentioned earlier, Trey Maynard and Frankie Edgar, so that he can fight the winner of that for the belt, because he was the belt holder in the WBC before they merged. Also, we have Chris Cope versus Chuck O'Neill. Oh, there's one. Yes. I take that back. He was one of the guys on the show, so he's going to be featured. Ed Herman versus Tim Credor. Fabio Maldonado versus Kyle Kingsbury. George Roop versus Josh Grisby. Scott Jorgensen versus Ken Jones. Daniel Downs versus Jeremy Stevens. Justin Edwards versus Clay Harbison. Shamar Bailey versus Ryan McGilvery. And Ruben Duran versus Francisco Rivera. So there's actually a few guys. I'm going to have to eat my words. I guess I looked at that earlier when those guys weren't listed. But there's a bunch of guys now. So I was right. They did add it just before the show. Justin Edwards and Clay Harbison were on the show. Shamar Bailey was on the show. Ryan Gilvery was on the show as well. Danny Downs, we just had him on our show not too long ago. He's fighting Jeremy Little Heathen Stevens. So that should be a good one. And somebody mentioned on the conference call today that he could have a second career as a comedian. I don't know if you noticed that when we talked to him. I think he was the one that was kept talking about your nickname, the Tornado.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a good
nickname. And also, on that fight I was talking about before, that was Travis Brown who knocked out Stefan Struve in the first round with just under a minute to go in the first round. Also on that card, we had Michael McDonald beat Chris Carriasso by decision. Gleison Tibau beat Rafaelo Oliveira by rear naked choke submission in the second round. Tim Boach beat Kendall Grove by unanimous decision. And Boach, they actually mentioned he was a Lockhaven graduate. Didn't know if you were aware of that.
What did they say about when or how old is he?
I don't know if they said when, but I'll check to see if his date of birth is on here. They mentioned, actually, Bruce Buffer was mentioning Lockhaven a lot, too. He talked about their wrestling program and where they were and all that. So I thought that was pretty funny. It says he was born in 1981. So it's like he was probably maybe...
yeah, he would have been there after I graduated. You figure
81,
that was 5 years after me, so.
Yeah, he beat the crap out of Kendall Grove, so he did Lockhaven proud. Demetrius Johnson, Miguel Torres by unanimous decision. Ryan Stan knocked out Jorge Santiago by knockout. Well, obviously he knocked him out by knockout. punches in the second round. Rick Story beat Thiago Alves by unanimous decision. It was probably one of the best fights on that card. And like I said, Frank Mir and Roy Nelson went the distance. Didn't look good for Roy. Roy supposedly going to be sitting down with Dana White tomorrow to talk about his future league, or lack thereof. We don't know. And there's been a lot of talk in the blogs about his physicality, of course. He also claimed over the last week that he had walking pneumonia, and he was in the hospital just a few days before the fight. So that might have had something to do with it, but my guess is there was a little bit more to it than that. Now, Louis's got a great chin, and he got hit with just about everything he could possibly get hit with in the fight. He just didn't look good himself and didn't have any answers strategy-wise or, you know, just didn't look good against Mir. And Dana White also criticized Mir, saying that Mir didn't look good at all. Which brings us back to our favorite point of, you know, Dana White's a boxer size instructor. That's all he is. He never fought really much at all, if anything, in his whole freaking life, you know? And he likes to make fun of these guys. And not just make fun of, but criticize their performance like he could do better.
Right.
Which blows my mind. You know, it's one thing if he says that on the Ultimate Fighter show where he gets all his mic time. But when you're talking about established professionals who have been in the game longer than you've been president of the UFC, then I think you should shut your mouth. You know, or at least just say, well, I don't think he states it as a fact with bravado, which I don't care for. I think he's way off base in the fight, you know?
And believe me, and the last thing you can ever accuse me of is being a Dana White supporter, ever. But on the other side of it, I mean, look at the biggest boxing promoters over the last, you know, half century. Did either of them ever get dirty in the ring? King and Bob Arum? The only boxing promoter out there that actually came from a fighting background really is Oscar De La Hoya.
Right. As far as we know. Freddie Roach used to fight, but he's not a promoter. He's a
promoter, he's a trainer.
And he wasn't a very good fighter.
You know,
good enough.
You know, he was not as good a fighter as he was a trainer.
Right.
You know, we'll put it like that. I mean, he still fought some top-notch guys. He fought some contenders. He was a fringe contender. You know, he wasn't a world-caliber guy, but he was a fringe contender. But he's not a promoter. He's a trainer. There's a difference. I'm talking about the guys. Like, you have trainers, you look at and these are the guys that are in the corners. Look how many of them are former fighters. And I'm going to list some of the good ones and some of the not-so-good ones. You figure, Freddie Roach was a trainer, but then he was also trained by Eddie Futch, who was a legendary trainer. Eddie Futch would have been a very good professional. He had a heart murmur. And back then, you know, he couldn't have all the tests done like you do today in the end of his career. Look, guys, both the Mayweathers, even though I don't think highly of them as trainers, were both fighters. Buddy McGirt was a fighter. A lot of guys that had ease in the training were original fighters. Now, you guys at the promoters, those are the money guys. Those are the guys that are businessmen. You know, you don't get many promoters out there that were former fighters. These are the guys like in the schoolyard, Rich, where say me and you went to school together. And you're a tough guy, and I'm a tough guy. And then there's that one little short, fat, ugly kid. He's going to say, hey, Tony, you know, Rich said, you know, he could kick your butt. You know, he says, you would never be able to beat him in a fight. And I'm getting pissed off. Hey, Rich, you should hear what Tony said about you. He said this and that, and he was making fun of you this. And now you're all pissed off. And then this guy gets the letter, hey, man, 3 o'clock today at the school, Tony and Rich are going to fight, man, 3 o'clock. All the school shows up to watch us fight. And who gets all the accolades? This guy. He's the one that basically put everything together and got all the hype going.
He's the one that, hey, give me a dollar and I'll tell you where the fight's going to be. Give me a dollar, I'll tell you where the fight's going to be. So you got 50 kids each paying him a buck to, you know, show up at whatever park and watch us fight. We're getting our butts kicked. And then, you know, and he's collecting all the money.
That's where a promoter comes from. That's a Don King. That's a Bob Arum.
Sounds like you should write Don King's biography.
You know?
Is that how he got started?
Very, you know, it wouldn't surprise me. Really wouldn't. How'd you get started? Well, you know, set all the fights in the schoolyard.
I don't know. Sounds right. Sounds right up his alley. But yeah, it's just Dana White's way. He opens his mouth and shit flies out. It's the way things
pretty
go.
Hard.
But, I don't know, we'll see. See what happens there. The other thing that Roy Nelson probably got under Dana's skin for saying was regarding the David aspect. You know, he says, well, I got paid better when I fought in the IFL. So it was sort of funny. You know, and that's obviously one of the things we always bring up when we talk about boxing versus MMA, is that these guys haven't been paid enough. And for the second straight time on a conference call today, they wouldn't let me ask a question. And I got my buzz in very early. I didn't change it or anything. So I don't understand what the heck's going on there. But I got all the way until the end of June. There's like three more conference calls to see if they do have some kind of blacklist on me. They don't let me ask questions. But I still want to ask, you know, all these guys whether they think it's time for a $1 million payday. We'll see. I know that, you know, all these events are selling out. They don't have a lot of overhead costs, especially when they're in Vegas. So I just can't figure it out. Although they did save, McDiaz. He is going to fight George St. Pierre. They made it official just the other day. Dana White went on Twitter, and he mentioned that the fight is going to happen. So we will see that. As to when, I think it's UFC 137 in October, on October 29th. And that was the same day as the stock market crash, wasn't it? Back in 1929. Black Friday. Let's see. Let me check that for sure. Yeah, UFC 137. Nick Diaz versus George St. Pierre, and that will, I think, be, well, I know, that will be the official first Strikeforce versus UFC fight. And, you know, if they do it once, they're not going to be afraid to do it again, I'm sure. I think the most difficulty they were facing with that whole issue of crossover fights was the Showtime contract. And, of course, the Showtime people were the ones that sent me the conference call list. So, but it's interesting. The speculation of the Diaz versus St. Pierre fight started after UFC 129. And it's been going ever since. He said, you wanted it, you got it, Dana White said on his Twitter. So it's going to be in Las Vegas at the Mandalay Bay Event Center, and it's UFC 137, October 29th. And Diaz's manager, Cesar Gracie, told MMA Fighting's Ariel Helwani on Wednesday that under Diaz's multi-year, multi-fight deal, he will also be able to return to fight for Strikeforce. Though Gracie said that if that were the case, it would likely mean that he had lost to George St. Pierre. Which is interesting, because if he wins, then he vacates the belt, I would assume. And somebody in the Strikeforce would have to fight for that. Well, guys, Strikeforce would end up fighting for that. And Diaz would stay in the UFC. I don't know whether it's a good idea or not, what it's going to mean for the future, as far as other guys crossing over, but previously, not that we should be surprised that it doesn't come true as it was said, but previously Dana White said that it's going to be business as usual. The only fighters that would potentially cross over would be guys that might come from the UFC and go into Strikeforce and fight there. But now we're having the opposite, totally opposite happen. And it seems like they're doing it particularly to keep Nick Diaz from going into boxing and setting an example for some of these other fighters that are pissed about what they're getting paid. But getting back to boxing, we have some interesting fights coming up this weekend. On Saturday from Denmark, we have Mikkel Kessler coming back. He's 43-2 with 32 knockouts, fighting Mehdi Bouadla, who's 22-3 with 10 knockouts. And that's going to be on Showtime. So if you catch that, also on the card, there's a few other halfway decent fights. Not that I've heard of any of these people, but a light welterweight 8-rounder between Kim Poulsen, 17-1 with 4 knockouts, and Tariq Sahibeddin, who's 12-8 with 2 knockouts. Then we go over to the UK. We have a fight over there between Gavin Reese, who's 34-1 at lightweight, 16 knockouts, fighting Andy Murray, 24-0, with 12 knockouts. That's for the vacant EBU lightweight title. And the co-main event there is Carl Frampton, super bantamweight, is 9-0 with 6 knockouts, fighting Robbie Turley, who's 10-3 with 1 knockout. Let's see what else we got. Did we miss any big boxing matches last weekend?
Well, there was the Chris Arreola fight on ESPN. Chris looked pretty good. He was in the 236 pounds. You know, wasn't jiggling too much. You know, looked a lot leaner. And he fought Kendrick Relaford, and he took it to him. Chris was very impressive, walked him down. They were talking about stopping the fight. You know, the announcers were. A couple rounds before he actually did, he finally put him down. Relaford got up, and then the next round he hit him with a couple shots and, you know, forced a stoppage right there, which was a very good stoppage because Relaford was obviously out of it. That was really it. I'm trying to remember if there was anything on Saturday night. And I wasn't home Saturday at all, day or night, so I didn't get to catch any combat sports at all on Saturday night. Except Friday, because I was doing so much this weekend, I purposely stayed in just to watch the Arreola fight.
I didn't get to catch any boxing last weekend either. But we got plenty this weekend that hopefully I'll be able to catch some off, even though the UFC fight's going to be on Saturday. We have a decent fight from the Hard Rock in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Saturday, between main event Johnny Tapia and Mauricio Pastrana. Tapia is 58-5 with 30 knockouts. Pastrana is 35-15 with 23 knockouts. Both of them have 2 draws. And then there's 3 welterweight fights on the card. Nothing too outstanding there.
I don't have the exact number, but you know what I would like to add to Johnny Tapia's record? He said he's 58-5. I would also like to add in there, pronounced clinically dead so many times. The guy literally, and I'm not joking around this, I'm not saying this would be funny either, with drug overdoses and his hard style life was, and I remember them saying it on multiple occasions, I would say, if I had to guess, no less than 4 or 5 times, the man was pronounced clinically dead. Let me be the loco, you know? You keep coming back. You have all Johnny Tappy's been fighting? I remember watching Johnny Tappy on ESPN back when I was watching. I remember he was fighting four rounders on ESPN when he only had one tattoo. And I think it was like in the late 80s.
I believe it. So, sounds like he's back in training, ready to go, though. We'll see how well he does. But also on Saturday down in Florida from the Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino, we have a few interesting fights, though the main event doesn't seem like much, between middleweights Dominique Dalton, 10-0 with 6 knockouts, and Donatas Bondoravis, 12-2 with 3 knockouts, 1 draw. We have a couple heavy guys on the card that are interesting matchups. O'Neal Bell at cruiserweights, 26-3 with 1 draw and 24 knockouts. He's fighting Richard Hall, who's 29-8 with 27 knockouts. Also at heavyweight, Cedric Boswell, 34-1 with 26 knockouts. He's fighting Kurtson Manswell, who's 20-2 with 15 knockouts. And then we got to go to the big Showtime fight of the weekend from Boardwalk Hall in Atlantic City. And it's Carl Froch, 27-1 with 20 knockouts, fighting Glenn Johnson, 51-14 with 35 knockouts. You going?
Good fight. No, fighting at the work this weekend, I would go.
Oh. Well, this fight's actually for the WBC Super Middleweight title as well as part of the Super 6 tournament. So it should be a pretty decent fight. I'm pulling for Glenn Johnson. You know, it's quite a feat for him to be still fighting at his age. He's creeping up there towards 50, so I'm hoping he can pull off the upset. I'm pretty sure he's not the favorite going in, but he definitely has what it takes. We'll see what happens. See if Carl Froch is on his game. There's also a couple light heavyweight fights on this card. Three, to be exact, that are interesting. There's actually another one, too, that's a six-rounder. But there's two eight-rounders, and one, the 10-rounder is the co-main event. Zolt Erdai, 32-0, with 17 knockouts, is fighting Byron Mitchell, 28-7, with 21 knockouts. And Edison...
Time to train in Philadelphia.
I was kind of impressed. Zolt did? Yeah, he was. They were talking about him. He's training in Philadelphia. He's training with the one gym that I would not hop in, but usually frequents. Cool. Edison Miranda is also on this card. 33-5 with 29 knockouts, fighting an 8-round light heavyweight fight with Rico Saunders. Guy I interviewed a couple times back in the day, who's probably
you know, I mean, this is a good opportunity for Rico. I mean, he's had his share of bad luck, but I mean, you're stepping up and there's a chance, you know, to make an impact on a guy that's got a name.
Yeah, his last fight was in December of last year. He had a tough unanimous decision loss. Lost by at least 10 points on two cards and 11 on another. Versus a guy who was undefeated, 13-0, named Ismael Salak. But before that, he fought in three straight Pennsylvania fights. One in Pittsburgh, one in Monroeville, and one in Johnstown. And he won all of them. Against guys with near 500 records, but the one before his last loss, he won by unanimous decision. One before that, he won by knockout in the eighth round, and he had a split decision win and a unanimous decision win. So he was actually on a four-fight win streak, which almost matched his best in his career. He's had a 6-fight win streak to start his career, and then a 5-fight win streak in the middle of his career. But that's been the best he's done in a long while. And we'll see if he rises to the occasion. I'm sure he'll do all right. But he's actually from Pittsburgh, it says on here. I didn't know that. Should have known that. But yeah, it's a big opportunity for him. Hopefully, it'll be televised. Also on the card, light heavyweight Alan Green, 29-3. 20 knockouts, fighting Dafir Smith, who's 24-20 with 4 knockouts, 7 draws. Then, of course, we have the HBO card that's going to be going up against this one on Saturday night from the Staples Center in Los Angeles, California. And we have Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., going against Sebastian Zivic, and somebody's O has got to go. We got 42-0 Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. He's got 30 knockouts, 1 draw, and then Sebastian Zivic is 30-0 with 10 knockouts, and it's for the WBC middleweight title. Also on the line, at light middleweight, we have a co-main event, Deans Moderosian, 29-0, 18 knockouts, fighting Saul Roman, 34-8, with 29 knockouts. And this is the fight that Christy Martin is going to be coming back on, too, on this card. She's fighting Dakota Stone. She is 49-5 with 31 knockouts, 3 draws. Dakota Stone is 9-8 with 1 knockout, 5 draws. 5 draws in 17 fights. That's tough to do. We'll see how she does there. That's a 6-rounder comeback fight. She had to cancel her last attempt to come back for whatever reason. I forget. But also on this card, we have a couple titles on the line at featherweight. NABF featherweight title and the WBO-NABO featherweight title. Going to be contended between Miguel Angel Garcia, 25-0 with 21 knockouts, and Rafael Guzman, 28-2 with 20 knockouts. So what do you think on the main event there? You think Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. is going to win, or Zivic?
Well, I mean, they're really pumping Chavez Jr. up. I know they won. I mean, Zivic's not a bad fighter, but I think they're stacking this deck, you know, towards Chavez. You know, he's son of a legend. He's got the name. And you know what? In all honesty, he's not a bad fighter. He's not his father, but how many times is the son the father? James McGirt Jr. wasn't Buddy. Ronald Hearns sure as hell wasn't Thomas. You know. I mean, obviously, Floyd was much better than his father. But Julio Jr. is not going to be his father, but he's still a pretty good goddamn fighter. The fight's in Los Angeles. He's going to have a big, Mexican following there. And I think that's going to carry him here. I don't know much about Zivic, I'll be totally honest. I've never really had the opportunity to see him fight. I know he's a tough guy. But, I mean, I think you
got to
go with Junior here.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen either guy fight too much myself. But just looking at the knockout percentage, I mean, it's heavily favored towards Chavez. And a guy who's undefeated like that, with that many wins, sometimes, especially since he's the son of a former boxing greats, you'd have to look at whether he's had a lot of hand-picked opponents. And I think he's kind of been taking it easy through the ranks through a lot of his career and matched up stylistically so he can keep that undefeated record going. He does have the one draw on his record. But, you know, it's no coincidence that we're against a fellow undefeated fighter. It's a guy who only has 10 knockouts for 30 straight wins. That's pretty interesting. And his draw was back in 2005 against Carlos Molina, who I've seen actually in action out here in Las Vegas. And I know he can fight. It's pretty interesting. And he's had a pretty good career. He's been stepping up his competition lately. A little bit. He fought John Duddy last year, which is a pretty big step up.
And he beat Duddy up pretty good.
Yeah, he won a unanimous decision there. His last fight was against Billy Lyell January 29th this year. Before those two fights, he fought three straight fights where you total up all three fighters' records, and they had over 20 wins, each of them, and less than three losses. One of them was a no contest. That's Troy Rowland, who had two losses. But he fought Jason Lahoulier before that, who had only one loss. And then
Jason Lahoulier was a very tough fighter. His only loss was to a former guest of ours, Harry Yorgi.
And then Luciano Leonel Coelho, who was undefeated at 23-0. And that's where Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. won the WBC Latino light middleweight title. Now he has the full-fledged WBC title. And he's moved up a weight. So he's middleweight now. And he's moving up the ranks. He looks good. 30 knockouts for 42 fights. Pretty impressive. And although he sits, like you say, he's not his father, he's definitely making a name for himself, definitely creeping up the ranks there pretty well. And he's ready for a lot of different competition. And I think he will win. Looking at that record compared to Zibic, we will have to check Zibic's record out here. Zibic's last fight was against Jorge Sebastian Hyland, who was 16-0. That was over in Hamburg, Germany, where he's had most of his fights. Before that, he fought Domenico Spada, who was 30-2, and he won that by unanimous decision. Both of those fights were for the interim WBC middleweight title, which kind of puzzles me. I don't know how you fight twice in a row for the interim title. How is that possible? He fought 4 times in a row for the interim WBC middleweight title. What, did they have a tournament? What is going on there?
I don't know, maybe he was defending it. I don't know. He was defending the title, but he was only temporary holding.
4 straight times? I don't know. Fought Domenico Spada twice in those 4 times. Also fought Manuel De La Rosa, who was 22-0. So he's obviously been matched up very well in his last few fights. And hasn't really had an easy fight since 2007, when he had a match against William Ruiz at 165, who was 31-23. He knocked him out in the first round. But he's had a lot of unanimous decisions, so that shows you that he doesn't have close fights. Yeah, his last split decision was against De La Rosa. That was in 2009, December of 2009. And I think, actually, that's his only split decision in his whole career. He's had nothing but knockouts and unanimous decisions otherwise. So if he wins, it's probably going to be by decision. And he's going to have to take a lot of the rounds. So we'll see. Other than that, that's pretty much does it for the weekend. So we do have one fight on Sunday in New Zealand worth mentioning. And that's going to be a light middleweight main event between Anthony Mundine, 41-4 with 24 knockouts, and Xavier Tolliver, who's 23-6 with 15 knockouts. And it's going to be a light heavyweight co-main event between Daniel Bath, 12-1 with 10 knockouts, one draw, fighting Warren Fueva, who's 11-0 with 3 knockouts. And that's about it for the boxing schedule. We got our boy coming on in a little while, John Greenberg, just a few minutes here, till we get him on. And he is the author of a book about Riddick Bowe. So we hope that we're going to be able to see that movie coming out. Shortly. I don't know whether it's coming out in the next year or so, or it's going to take longer than that. But apparently we have Greg is coming on a guest at 9 Eastern. And apparently he's actually working on a movie about the book on Riddick Bowe. And he says there's a lot of surprises, a lot of interesting stuff. I know that, didn't he join the Marines at one point?
Yes. After his retirement, I guess it was about, if he retired in like early 97, I guess it was, I think he joined the Marines in like maybe late 97, early 98. He quit after 3 days, and you know, and the first 2 days were like orientation, really. And they, you know, he just, I mean, and I guess when he came from where he came from, I mean, he was, you know, a heavyweight champion of the world. I mean, he basically ran his entourage, and now, I mean, these guys. Not only was the drill sergeant obviously going to make him an example, saying, you know what, here, you're lower than nothing. And I guess that was something he really couldn't handle. But here's what really would have interested me. You know, a lot of times, like, I have a friend of mine right now that's, you know, in police training. He's looking to be a police officer. And he emailed me the one day. He was all, like, humbled and everything. He's like, man, they had us put the gloves on in there, and I kind of get my ass handed to me. And I remember a friend of mine that was in the Marine Corps back in the mid-90s, he was like, you know, we were talking, we were sending emails and stuff, and he's like, yeah, they're having us put the gloves on with each other and kind of banging each other around and getting my ass kicked. And I was like, but imagine if they did that with, like, somebody like Riddick Bowe. I mean, how badly would he have torn some of these guys up?
Yeah. Well, he wasn't in the greatest shape of his career when he went into the Marines.
Yeah, but a lot of these guys that are, you know, military guys that are, you know, training and everything, yeah, they're in good, like, shape for cardiovascular things, running far distances, climbing mountains, you know, lugging heavy, you know, packs of artillery and, you know, marching and jogging and all that. But Riddick Bowe was a trained, professional, heavyweight champion who knew, even if he was on his worst shape, he had the skills and the experience. Like right now, I'm in terrible shape. For an average human being, I was never a guy that would be a good runner. We used to, when we'd run as a team at Lock Haven, we'd do it few and far in between. You usually ran on your own, thank God, because I was always the last of the pack. You know, I wasn't a fast guy. I didn't have the stamina to run with these other guys. You know, but I mean, you look at me now, it's like, yeah, shit, I can barely run at all. You know, I'm not, you know, but for your average human being, yeah. I'm in pretty good shape for an average human being. And, yeah, you know, right now I got the gut going and everything, and I'm not in, you know, the great shape that I used to be. But I'd still whoop a lot of guys' asses. And you take guys that are in much better shape than I am, that can run and all that, and you put them on the heavy bag, and I'll still outdo them every night.
All right. Yeah, and Riddick, it's an interesting character. He's got a lot, probably had a lot of stories to tell Mr. Greenberg here. We're working on getting him on in just a second here. There was also domestic violence. You right?
With his wife, sure. And don't forget, I mean, you got a lot of things to deal with his, you know, with his former manager, Rock Newman, who was always ahead of controversy. You got those things to talk about. I know that fight with Elijah Tillery on USA, and Tillery tried to kick Bo in the nuts after the round was over, and they kept swinging. There's Newman pulling Tillery over the top rope while Bo was swinging away. So the guy had such potential for a great career, but it was marred with controversy. Now, unfortunately, like, Eddie Futch to Riddick Bowe was like Customato to Mike Tyson. And Rock Newman was like Don King, the guy that would just fuck up anything.
We're going to add him right now, John Greenberg. Get some more. We also have to talk about the Fan Man incident, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Good evening, John Greenberg. Could I help you?
John, hey, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron from the
Fight. Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Yep.
Okay. Good. Glad to hear from you.
We also have our boxing guy. We call him the Boxing Rain Man on the line, Tony the Bill Penicale.
Good.
Hey, what's up?
Hello?
Hey, how you doing?
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great.
Good. Okay, so we can all hear each other?
Yep.
We're good. We've got something going.
All right.
Good.
So, John, you're working on a book about Riddick Bowe. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the book has been finished. And now we are in negotiations to possibly have a movie done. Yeah,
awesome.
So it's taken a different path because originally we were going to get the book out, but now because of the interest in a movie deal, now it's in the negotiation to, you know, possibly bring this thing to the big screen. And it's quite exciting to have that happen. But I think first of all, this is a story that's much bigger than boxing. Because nobody really got into his the way he grew up, and also his personal life. Now, you know, with you being a boxing expert, you probably were aware of the things that happened with when he tried to go into the Marine Corps and
absolutely, we were just talking about it,
right? And we get into that, but. You know, I don't want to get into. They don't want me to be talking about what's specifically in this story, but the things that you saw, like the domestic violence charges and the fact that he went to prison for 18 months, all of that is the real background about all of those occurrences is part of this story.
Cool. Now, I read that you started out with writing a lot about football. And it's kind
of right.
We have a lot in common because actually that's how I got my start in the newspapers.
Okay.
So I thought that was interesting. But how did you get a hold of the story with boxing and really?
Well, what happens is that I did a book about Amos Alonzo Stagg. And that book was all set to be published, and ESPN, do you recall when they did that series, Rights of Autumn? I don't know if they actually ever put it on in its entirety, but they were going to do it was going to be like a 3 or 4 part mini-series about the history of college football. And I was on that because of Amos Alonzo Stagg and some other things, And then the Major League, we had that 9/11 disaster, and that resulted in the baseball playoffs being moved forward a week. So that blew that time slot out. And that kind of finished that project off for the time being. And then, you know, as time went on, I got in contact with a couple of people, Sea Captain. I did a book, Captain Courageous, My True Story. And then, you know, after that, this Riddick Bowe thing just kind of happened because he was working with a man who wanted to help him get his life story put in print. And I was there, and the man introduced me to him, and then that's how the whole thing started. This has been going on for about 2 years now.
Cool. And is there
when people mention Riddick Bowe, now obviously you can talk about the controversial fights with Andrew Gullotta.
Right.
Nobody will ever forget about a fan man.
Is a huge current.
I missed that when it happened live because I was at my senior year homecoming dance that night. And I remember coming home because obviously the days before cell phones and everything. And I came home, and my dad hadn't watched the fight that night because I wasn't going to be home. You couldn't go on the internet like you used to, but we were on ESPN, to see what happened, and they're showing still photos and talking about it, and we're sitting there going, What is this? It was ridiculous. But the thing that the two things that I'll remember most about Riddick Bowe, I didn't really get to meet him when I was 15 because I was a fight card. I was 15 years old. It was only 6 months before he won the title from Holyfield. And we're down in Atlantic City, and Michael Moore was fighting Bert Cooper. Riddick had a win over Cooper about a year and a half earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a life and death fight. Like Cooper had Moore down twice. Moore got up, knocked Cooper down, eventually knocked him out 5 rounds. And we're walking through the lobby, and I'm a 15-year-old kid, and I want to get involved in the box game, but I didn't know how. And here comes Riddick Bowe, all 6'5" of him, larger than life. And the guy walks up to him and goes, "Riddick, what if that was you in the ring tonight?" And he stopped and he smiled and he said, "Michael Moore would have been like this." And he laid his hand out to indicate that he'd be flat on the canvas. And I looked at him, and I was too shy to go up and get an autograph, which I really regret. Even now that I do this on the show with Rich, and I'm at a fight card, I'm handing for photos and handing out business cards and shaking hands. My dad's like, "Oh, you're the ultimate politician now." But the other one that I'll never forget was, this is even before he became champion, and they were talking about his upbringing in the Brownsville section of New York, and Riddick talking about, seeing Mike Tyson walking down the street and said how everybody would cross the street, and he'd be like, "And I would too." And but how he used to walk his mother to the bus station every day.
Right. He would walk her to work. She worked the midnight shift at a plastics factory. And, he has always been devoted to his mother because he never knew who his father was.
Right.
Which is, just thinking about that's an enormous issue right there. When you talk about Brownsville, he grew up in a section called East New York. And when he grew up there, that was known as Little Vietnam. We're talking about the early and mid-80s when the crack cocaine had become an epidemic in that area. So, there's an awful lot. You being a boxing expert, I'm sure you'll agree that the great boxers always came from the lowest rung of society at any given time. First, it was the Irish.
Those are guys that were always the hungriest.
Right.
I mean, and it's not even a socioeconomic thing.
No.
I shouldn't say that. It's not always a an ethnicity thing. It's the guys that are the hungriest.
Right.
I mean, you take a look at a guy like Jack Dempsey, who was a hobo.
Right.
He was a hobo. Joe Frazier was a guy that had next to nothing.
Right.
And he was fighting because, you know, he had a baby child and he was trying to provide.
Right.
Mike Tyson. Even
Jack
a guy like
Johnson
Rocky
had. You know, Jack Johnson had really nothing. I mean, you know, but this is because, like I used to mention to him when we were, you know, we spent hours together on this book, and I would say to him, you know, you weren't involved in a sport like football or basketball or baseball where there's an actual league, and where you have a coach, you know. I mean, you don't have teammates, and this is what makes boxing so special. But then again, you got to have this tremendous drive that actually you're not striving towards something. You are escaping from something. You're doing all you can to get out of a really, really, really horrible situation.
I'll tell you, where I trained growing up in Philadelphia, and I mean, I had a good upbringing. You know, I had two parents that worked hard. You know, those were some, you know, my grandmother was there until I was 13, so she passed away. I had a good upbringing, but I wanted to box because I thought it was a cool sport, and I always liked it. So I wanted to box, so I ended up starting boxing on the collegiate level, you know. And I didn't have natural athletic ability like other guys did. I was a short, stocky guy. And for me, I couldn't get by on natural ability. I had to get by on toughness, guts, and punching power. But I also had to learn how to learn the intricacies of the sport or I was going to take a beating getting inside. And I ended up, and just by chance, one day my dad was working, and the one guy that he was working with had a ringside boxing hat on. They start talking. I was about maybe 2 months into my amateur career at the time, up, 2 or 3 hours away from home. And the guy happened to be a trainer in, a tough inner city gym in Philadelphia, invited me down to work out with them. And I went there. And the guys at first didn't want to accept me because they didn't know who I was. I was the only white kid in the gym. And, you know, I wasn't from their same streets. But the trainer, you know, he brought me in. And then a couple of the guys that were, like, friends of his that were, like, they were boxers, but they weren't competing anymore. They were just kind of going there to get in shape and to help the younger guys. They took me under their wing. So now it's like then the other guy started accepting me once I got in the ring and I proved myself. You know, I proved, you know, even though I wasn't from, you know, their same streets, that, you know, I was still, you know, in that same ring and I was willing to, you know, go blood and guts with them. But the one thing I noticed about boxing, it was a real bad area where our gym was. I mean, it was a crack house right across the street. But it was a rec center. And the rec center, the guys on the basketball court, there'd always be, you know, some shenanigans going on. We saw guns get pulled on the basketball court. But in the actual boxing gym of the rec center was nothing but treated with nothing but reverence by the guys that were running around the rec center, even the young kids. They knew if they had to go in the boxing gym, they had to be on their best behavior because the trainers there were very serious. And the one trainer happened to be one of Matthew Saab Muhammad's old trainers. So these guys had some good pedigree, and they knew that, you know, when you had to go into the boxing gym, you had to behave yourself. And there was also a martial arts instructor there that had been shot 6 times years earlier and got up and walked away. So nobody was more respected than him. So that was kind of the respect that, you have, like, your thugs out there and everything and your troublemakers, but they never messed with the boxing gym.
Well, that speaks volumes, and when you hear about these terrible situations going on in Chicago, all this violence and things like that, you wonder, that's a place that they should be encouraging boxing gyms and or MMA or anything, because
exactly.
you know, those sports are really very inclusive. I mean, you could have, you know, little people, you can have big people, you can have any size people involved in boxing and MMA. But you've got to get them involved in something that that they can gain respect and that they can gain a desire to win and to feel that they can go out and accomplish something and get a bond, start to feel that there's other people in this world that are going through the same thing that I'm going through.
Well, and the thing with boxing, like, I know we have guys come in that gym, some were young kids, and the guys that were the trainers there would discipline them. Because these kids could go out on the basketball court and everybody can just grab a ball. There's, you know, 10 baskets around there and anybody can shoot and have pickup games and talk trash and do whatever. There was
no supervision.
Exactly. There was no supervision and there was no, there wasn't like a rigid time restraint to it, and there wasn't anything like that. There wasn't no I'm trying to think of the perfect word to use here, but there was no system for it. In the boxing gym, yeah, there was a system. You're going to come in, you're going to you're going to do your work, you're going to learn.
Well, that's ironic because when you think about when basketball started and all the years that it developed, they would have coaches for all these the different programs. And football is the same thing, you know. And now you look at the NCAA situation, you get the best players are really not going to play in college basketball. They go from high school right into the NBA, you know. And that's kind of a sad situation, but... But beyond that, boxing being so inclusive, and plus you got women boxing is accepted now. It's going to be in the Olympics, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting to me because I actually used to coach boxing up at Norwich University in Vermont. We had a club team that I started. And all of a sudden one day, there was like 30 girls who came out to practice, and... For the life of me, I couldn't figure it out at first, but then I come to find out they were all there for the ab workouts that we used to do at the end of practice. You know, so it's kind of a different dynamic why guys get involved than girls sometimes.
Right.
A lot of the guys, I mean, we like just the benefit of being able to tell somebody, hey, I'm a boxer. Right. And it is one of those tough sports where... You know, it is sometimes you get in the ring and you're lucky to escape without, getting damaged too bad. But, you know,
well,
there's a badge of glory part of it, too.
There's a respect.
Right.
You know, under ideal, the way it should be is that there's a respect of the two people that are competing against each other. And, you know, there was a time when they actually had NCAA boxing and they had a national tournament. I knew some guys who boxed in those things a long, long time ago. We're talking 50, 60 years ago. And, you know, with all the concussion problems they're having and CTE problems with football, you'd think that maybe boxing would be appropriate. But unfortunately... The lack of an American heavyweight is really hurting. It's really hurting the sport.
And I know from being on the college level for 4 years in the mid '90s, I was trained under Dr. Ken Cox. He was the alternate team manager for the '96 Olympic team in Atlanta. You know, he helped out with the guys down there. And when he was first talking to us, he talked to us about. When NCAA used to sponsor boxing at a collegiate level.
Right.
And then got, and he's saying it was back in the 50s or the 60s, I'm not exactly sure, but it got taken away because some schools were offering scholarships. So now they were basically cherry picking some of the best young fighters out there. And what had happened was one school had cherry picked a couple good kids. I forget if it was like a New York, it was a big time city and it was a big time university. They offered a full scholarship. They got a kid with a good bit of amateur experience, and he comes up to a tournament. He gets matched up against the guy that was basically a first-time boxer. And
The
first-time boxer was injured severely. I can't recall if they said it was a fatality situation or not. This was 17 years ago that I was first told about it.
Right, so we're talking...
Dropped boxing, and then it came back as a club sport. So, and I remember, it's like, there were guys that had like maybe two or three amateur fights, and then they were going to college and they wanted to start boxing. Well, it was the thing, they had to get a special waiver. So they would have like one bout that like did not count.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, and that five coaches would watch from opposing schools. So I remember I was involved in one of these waiver bouts. It was a kid from Penn State, had like three or four amateur fights. And he was 21, 22 years old. He was a little bit older than me. I was 21 at the time. And he was from Penn State Lake City. He had three or four amateur fights. They put him in there with me. And the first, and for me, unfortunately, I wasn't pumped up for it. I had just come off a big fight in Virginia. I was getting ready for a big fight in New York. Now I'm fighting up in the mountains of Pennsylvania in an afternoon card that doesn't count. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, I had no motivation. The guy dumped me on my ass in the second round. Then I got up and I was pissed off. And then we went toe-to-toe, and after it was over, everybody was looking at me, oh, my God. But the kid passed his waiver because, you know, obviously he showed that he wasn't a level above, but he wasn't a level below either. I mean, he kept pace with me. I was an All-American. So he eventually passed his waiver. That's how he got in.
Well, that's how upsets occur. That's how upsets occur. You just you catch a highly rated opponent on the right day, and bit that boom, there you are. Because it's
you can't beat Mike Tyson.
Right.
And this guy, you know, the Penn State coach knew me in and out. You know, he had known me for 4 years at the time, and he knew what I brought to the table. And he basically warned his guys, like, this guy, you know, even though this is a fight that doesn't count much, it's a guy that's going to test you, because that was me. I'm a very physical type of fighter, you know, short, stocky, power punching type guy. I'm a very physical type fighter. So he's like, he told this guy, he's like, you better be on your game. So even though I'm like, yeah, I really don't care, you know, this fight doesn't mean nothing to me, it meant something to him.
Well, it
and
right, like,
meaning something to him, just turned into meaning something to me.
That was the problem. At that moment in time, it just didn't mean as much to you as it probably should have. You know?
Right.
Because every time you go into the ring, every time you go into a game, it's got to be important enough. Otherwise, why play it or why fight?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting, too.
You know, I mean, it's easy for me to sit here and say that. You know, that's the way, but you see, that's the human condition, and that's why sports are so fascinating. And if hopefully we get some people who are administering these sports and can get off this money thing, we might get back to some of the joys of sport. This NFL lockout situation is just...
Oh, yeah, I know. Don't get me started on that.
It's ridiculous. And what do you guys think about this idea of paying college athletes?
Well, yeah,
their
scholarships. Don't you think they get enough, you know, to basically get, you know, let's look at some big colleges out there, UCLA, Penn State University, University of Alabama. These are some prestigious colleges there.
Like Notre Dame or Northwestern, where the tuition is approaching, you know, with everything, like $50,000 a year? That's
$200,000.
Well, there's a lot of stories. There's a lot of stories on the news lately about, you know, how college is starting to become overrated for a lot of these people and the debt these people face once they graduate, some don't ever recover from. And it's not necessarily that great of a deal to graduate with a degree these days what it's like to actually be out in the workplace for those 4 years and have a head start.
Right.
How many people are able to do that without degrees? But it's kind of funny you mentioned the paying to play aspect, because actually I was probably one of the only kids who graduated from my high school who actually was paid to go to college, because they paid us $60 a day when I went to Air Force Academy my first year.
Okay. Well, But when you think about it, let's say the Big Ten gets this thing through and they say we're going to give them $2,000 stipend per year above what their scholarship, or they used to call them grant and aids, whatever their bet gives them. It's never going to be enough. It's never going. Once you get into this money thing, it will never be enough. And now Steve Spurrier says, well, maybe we should give them $300 per game. But then again, that every school can't afford that.
Right.
Even if they're Division One.
And where does it stop? That's the problem. You know, it's just going to be a slippery slope.
And I think that it's like talking about the U.S. debt. We're getting to the day of reckoning where they're going to have to make some tough choices and just say, look, I'm sorry, if this guy, if you can't recruit players honestly, then you're just going to have to play the players that you can recruit.
Yeah.
And you'll be amazed that you'll probably sell just as many tickets at these schools that you sell now. Because the school is what sells them. It's not the players necessarily.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
I'd like to see them go back to the rules where if you came out of the game in the first quarter, you couldn't go back into the second quarter.
Right. It's ironic, though. I mean, when you look at the structure of society itself, and you see not only sports getting so much attention, but you know, once they get out of college and they get to the pro levels, they're getting paid, you know, six or seven figures to play a game. When some doctors don't even get paid that much.
Well, the doctors are an endangered group because before Medicare came in, back in the 1950s, the biggest problem a doctor had to worry about was dealing with the IRS because they were paid in cash.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and they would make house calls, and they were hungrier because they could actually go out and practice and not worry about the fact that they had all this paperwork to deal with and all these malpractice insurance premiums to pay, you know. But I think that there's going to be some big changes because I think that if this NFL lockout persists and they wind up losing several games and maybe not start till October, they're going to lose a lot of borderline fans.
Yeah, the thing that I just started thinking about too because I didn't realize it, but it came out in the news a couple weeks ago and I caught a report on it. Is you know, the thing that nobody talks about is the tax revenue from all these states that have stadiums and,
right.
You know, their government depends on the tax revenue from these games and the people that come in and they provide all the tourist dollars. Just so
well, these teams, these training camp sites are going to take a huge hit. If they don't have the regular training camps, those communities are just going to, they're going to take an enormous blow. And then you got this problem where, like, the Oakland Raiders, they need a new stadium. And I think the owners are promising Al Davis. This is why he's probably not, you haven't heard his name at all in any of these negotiations. He's probably keeping quiet because they're promising that they're going to arrange for him to get a new stadium. Jacksonville needs a new stadium. The three teams in California, they all need new stadiums. And those tax loopholes are being closed. Remember back in 86 when they came up with that tax loophole that enabled the NFL owners to keep all but 8% of what was brought in. The rest, only 8% went towards the bonds that built those stadiums. Well, that train has left the station and, you know, you're not going to see that again. So there's a lot of issues, and I think that with the way the economy is going, people just look at boxing. You know, you're not going to see any big you're not going to see any big pay-per-view contest for heavyweights for a long, 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 long time.
Yeah. So. it's getting to be a more of an overseas thing with the Russian guys at the top.
Right, the clip shows. And
even the guy challenging them now is a British guy. And they're actually doing something more dynamic than you see in the United States, where they have the prize fighter tournament over there that's making a lot of waves. And they had actually a couple American guys went over for the last one, the last prize fighter heavyweight tournament, where they go, I think, three rounds apiece, and then they fight three or four times a night. So that's making it a little bit more interesting for people, because you don't have a Mike Tyson out there knocking people out. But the United States is kind of falling behind MMA because they don't do anything dynamic anymore, and they don't have that stand-up guy who's knocking everybody out anymore. So people are actually gravitating towards, like, the welterweights with Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather, even though Mayweather hasn't been doing much. But the more dynamic guys are coming from those weight classes, and they're American, you know, whether they're Mexican or from the United States, they're from our continent, so more people are seem to be interested in them and their stories.
Do you think the MMA is going to arrive as a real major force as far as the general public watching it?
Well, I just actually started watching it in 2006, and I think that was one of those breakout years for the sport itself, where it was first on Showtime, and it actually got a real big foothold with the pay-per-views. But right now, it's starting to gravitate towards a monopoly, with the UFC taking over Strikeforce just recently. And Dana White is the main figure, and I actually had a guy that was a UFC veteran come on our show, and I forget who it was exactly, but he said, you know, something's wrong with MMA when Dana White is the most recognizable figure in the sport. It's like Don White being, or Don King being
the most recognizable man in boxing.
Yeah, and, you know, that's unfortunate when stuff like that happens, but it is what it is. The way I look at it is, you know, if that continues and these guys keep being, actually, I think they're worse than Don King, because they take the lion's share of everything. The guys who own the majority of the UFC are casino guys. So, you know, they're used to preying off losers, basically.
Right.
And taking all the money that they can get. So it's sort of a tough situation for guys that are a class of people that are easy to stereotype and easy to take advantage of, because they're not seen as very smart people, which is why you probably will never see a fighters union. But
no, and you probably won't see much of an upgrade of the image, because there's no real attachment to anything collegiate about it.
Right. Well, it's the college wrestling where a lot of the guys come from, because there's no professional wrestling that's real.
Right.
But, it's one of those situations where if they started paying people a little bit better, I might have a different outlook.
Mm-hmm.
And like in boxing, you don't hear about anybody talking about a boxers union, even though there is a lot of talk about, you know, some better retirement programs.
Well, as the NFL Players Association has proved, having a union is not going to guarantee any solution to life problems either.
No. Well, money talks is the bottom line. And
right. They
don't start offering million-dollar paydays with all the money that they're making for these different events and merchandising and TV shows.
The problem, though, is that if the money is coming from television, and it will eventually make whatever the sport is into a TV production,
right,
like the NFL. And now college football is basically trying to emulate the NFL, and I don't think that that's really a great thing. I think that was part of the magic of college football, was that there was an absolute difference in all these different teams. And now you don't see that as much. I don't even think you see it at all, except maybe the academies, they play a little bit different, but you know, everybody's running basically the same stuff, and it's, you know, but it, and it's so, you see, football will always be there, even if there were no television. But the NFL might not be around if there were no television.
Right. Yeah, I used to write a lot for the NFL. Last year I got a gig on opposingviews.com, so I used to predict all the games and wrote a lot about it and for the high school ranks when I first started newspaper business. And it's an interesting sport. I played a little myself even in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those sports where it's a really a popularity contest in the very beginning, which was what turned me off of it. So I think that's one of the things they have to work on. And you know, the team aspect isn't always there. Where I think when the Patriots had that long drought without a championship, and then they come out that year of 2001, and they end up winning the championship, it was all about all of a sudden the team.
Right.
Which, for a while, it was important, and it kind of threw everybody for a loop. But that was really a good message that they needed. And now you're getting back to that individual thing. You know, money, 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 pay me more. And
the coaches are being shoved out. They're being shoved to the margin. You know, I don't know what these locker rooms are going to be like if the season finally gets going, because, you know, the old owners, they used to want to win. These were guys that had made their millions in some other line of work, and they wanted to win beyond anything else. And now you don't have owners like that. You got grandsons of people, and you got you know, these big entities, and it's just it's a whole different situation, you know. And then you talk about high school. Where is the talent? Where is the talent going to come from? Because if this whole issue with the concussion starts to take hold, you may have a lot of parents that won't have their kids play football.
Yeah, I heard one guy make a lot of noise last year. I forget who it was, but I think it was Lou Holtz who said something like that. They actually probably did better when they didn't have helmets.
Well, if they took the face mask off, that might be safer. If they a busted nose is a lot better than a concussion. And I don't know if. I really don't know who was really looking after the game, because it's a little cloudy on who really controls it. You know, the NCAA, they had all those issues with Auburn and Oregon and now Ohio State and USC, and they still haven't decided what USC's, you know, final penalty is going to be. And as far as Bush giving the Heisman back, I mean, there's still some questions. I mean, this thing with Ohio State, this is gonna go on for some time, and it's.
It's been good for boxing though, with the lockout anyway, at the professional level, because a couple of guys that can't play football have gone over to boxing.
Yeah, I would say that might be interesting.
That's actually, a lot of people say that's one of the reasons why we don't have another Mike Tyson, is because a lot of these guys are going to football or basketball. This is more big money sports.
Well, Mike Tyson was a remarkable person, and all these guys that won championships are remarkable in their own way. And it's the only sad part is that where do they end up?
Yeah.
You know, this is the really disturbing thing about it. And I don't know any of them that really, you know, you'd say that they didn't have a fall from grace. maybe Lennox Lewis didn't. I don't know. And maybe the Klitschko's avoided that, but, you know, these, like, Holyfield and Bowe and Tyson and the rest of them, they sure had their miseries.
Yeah, and it seems like nobody ever taught them how to manage their money. And it's sort of ironic to me now that, like, over the last few months, actually, I think it was a couple of years ago, I heard that MC Hammer, another guy who lost all his millions, is right now a manager for MMA fighters.
Well, you know, the NFL players, that used to be a stepping stone. Like guys like Sam Huff and Fran Tarkenton and all these other people, they were using that to make contacts. And I don't know if that's even on their minds. I don't know if very many of them really even think about that. And that's frightening because these older ones that played in the 70s and 80s and 90s, there's some really, really horrific stories coming out about them because of their medical condition.
Well, in that situation, you at least have the college structure that's a little bit better than boxing. In boxing,
right,
like so many NCBA schools that are able to have a boxing program, whether it's an insurance issue or you know, whatever the reason, a lot more kids turn to the Golden Gloves to work their way up or the
right
Olympics, and they don't have to go to college to do that. So
right,
you don't have the structure or the background with a degree to do anything
right
when you can't fight anymore. And it happens even in MMA, too. I mean, I don't know what his experience is, but there was a kid on the last the Ultimate Fighter show that they have on TV. Mm-hmm. Just a couple weeks ago, they showed a fight where he damaged both of his retinas, so he's supposedly not even able to fight ever again. And he's like a teenager. You know, so what does he do if he's planned on his whole life to be a fighter? It's one of those tough situations. And I think fighters get a bad rap in general just because they seem to be easy to take advantage of. They don't seem to be seen as very smart people, even though a lot of them are. Some of them have college degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't always start with college, so it's tough to see guys like Tyson and Holyfield. They end up having all these millions just go down the drain. They can't even afford to make a living outside of the sport, even though Tyson got lucky.
Get a couple of movie roles or something and a reality TV series, but
he's still living in a gated community, though. So he's doing something.
Yeah. Well,
Holyfield, he unfortunately has to fight everywhere now to make a living.
Yeah, but you know, at least he's at least they have something going for them. Which, when you're a kid who's sitting in your mother's basement and you got a $125,000 student loan debt and you got a degree in political science or English literature.
Or mass communications, is that kind of the hard way?
Mass communications, yeah, that would be a degree that, I don't know, the law school graduates are, they're really taking it on the chin. You know, there are so many law schools, and it's just, I don't know. We live in interesting times.
Yeah.
And I don't know,
the Internet, too, is sort of interesting when you look at it. Because before, especially with an English degree like I have, and being an author like you are, you can relate to this.
Right.
A lot of times, getting up through the ranks of journalism was all about who you knew in the print media. But nowadays, you don't have to know anybody. You just have to know a little bit about computers, and you can end up being published all over the world if you make the right connections online and you get the right story out there.
It still helps a great deal to go out and network and meet people, because there's tons of stuff out there, and somehow, some way, you've got to get noticed. And this is the ongoing problem. I think even when they were, you know, you had publishing companies, you go back into the 1940s, you go into a city and see a newsstand, and there might be, 50, 60 newspapers there, tons of paperback books, and, you know, you still have to do something to stand out. Otherwise, you know, you're just going to have to take satisfaction in having gone out and accomplished something. But I don't know if people have really figured out how to use the Internet yet. And we've got so many kids that are growing up where everything is visual to them. And that's going to take a big adjustment on the part of some people to get their story out in a visual way. And, you know, and then look at all the money that they're pouring into these theaters to convert them to 3D. You know, and you know, there's always going to be a need for films that are downloaded or a direct to DVD because, you know, what does a 3D ticket cost now? You're talking, $15, $20 plus the glasses or the glass rental or whatever it is? So.
Yeah, I guess I actually heard that YouTube now is going to be offering paid downloads to people for movies. Instead of going right to DVD, they go right to YouTube now.
Right, Netflix and YouTube and all the rest of them. And so the content, there's always going to be a need for content. There, you know, just like there's always going to be a need for sporting events. And with the changing economy, who knows, this UFL, this might actually pick up. The MMA may pick up. Boxing may make a resurgence. If they can get the ticket prices affordable, that could be a big key because, you know, with this NFL lockout gets settled and then the average ticket price jumps to like $500 or $600, which is not, it's not really crazy.
Unfortunately. You know, as far as your movie goes, is there a timetable set up for this
As I was mentioning to somebody, they were talking about this, the movie The Fighter. Remember that one that came out recently?
Yeah, sure, Mickey Ward.
Right, that took 7 years.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's the thing is that if the deal gets struck, then the book can go out, you know, and then it can sort of pave the way. That's what I'm hoping for.
Right.
Because, you know, we'd like the story to get out, but right now, you know, we have to pursue this venue first, and then, you know, but it's great that there's interest in it, and I think this will really fill in a lot of gaps. Because people were always wondering, I'm sure, how this guy could have gotten into that domestic violence issue and that whole mess with the Marine Corps and the business about throwing his belt into the garbage can. You know. And the fan man thing, that was, that's still one of the most talked about events in the history of any athletic event. You know, the guy committed suicide a few years later.
Didn't he find up in Alaska or something?
Yeah, he wound up in a remote area, and he wound up committing suicide. I think that was about maybe 8 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago.
I don't think I ever heard that.
Yeah, he.
Yeah, I've seen that in Ring Magazine. They had mentioned it.
Well, it was, you know, you could say it was a fluky thing, but there's also, I think Riddick was interviewed several times, and he said that he believes that there was, it was a setup. because why did it have to happen at that particular point of the fight, and why was it that that this stoppage would even have to take place? I mean, it was just very, very strange. And it was an outdoor arena, and you know, as being a boxer yourself, I mean, if you get cooled off, it's going to take you some time to get warmed up again to fight.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember them sitting on stools for 21 minutes with blankets wrapped around them. But now here's my contradictory point on this. It actually almost looked like during the fight, if I remember correctly, the break in the action actually was more of a benefit to Riddick, because he was 11 pounds heavier in that fight than he was in his previous fight with Holyfield. And you could tell he wasn't in the best of shape. And I looked around the 6th, 7th round like he was a little bit winded.
Well, to be perfectly, you know, if you followed his career, you'd have to note that there was a difference in how he trained for that first fight with Holyfield and how he trained for all his other fights after that point. And he was up in a place called Bend, Oregon. And, you know, for some reason, they never trained at that place again. But that was the place that he really got into shape for a fight. So, you know, it's... I'll tell you... quite frankly, when you are striving to achieve a goal, and you are convinced that once you achieve that goal, you're going to be happy ever after, you're in big trouble. Because once you achieve that goal, you're only going to be happy for a certain period of time. And then you're going to have to move on to something else, because that your happiness is not going to last forever. You know, just like any really bad things that you go through in life, they don't last forever either. But I know that he never expected to really have to do anything after he had beaten Holyfield for the title.
Yeah, I hear about that a lot.
You know, he figured he was going to be able to do all that he had hoped to do for his mother and for his family by winning that title, and that would bring him everything that he wanted. And you know, we can sit here and say, well, he shouldn't have been thinking that way. But if you are thinking that way, this is setting you up for problems all the way down the line.
Exactly.
And that's a lesson to be learned from all of this. Is you have to realize that happiness is a moment-to-moment thing, and when you have it, you've got to grab it and live in that moment. But on the other hand, you've got to make choices and do things that are going to bring you as many moments of happiness as you can possibly have in your life. And then how do you do that? Well, you're not going to do it by dwelling on yourself. You're going to have to be concerned about others, and you're going to have to treat people the way that you want to be treated. You're going to have to really care about other people. Because if you're all by yourself and you've got millions of dollars and everything else, you won't be able to live that way, because you'll either kill yourself or you'll go insane.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, I think, one of the reasons why heavyweight boxing has kind of fallen off the map, because, you know, there used to be a time where the heavyweight champion would go all around the world and be an ambassador of the sport, really, and do great
right.
things for different communities and be a real representative of charity, and all sorts of, you know, good for the world as not only a symbol, but as somebody with a lot of money who could throw it around for people who really needed it as well. And you don't see as much of that anymore, unfortunately. I want to ask John, what do you think is the thing that you enjoyed the most about working on the Riddick Bowe story, and what do you love most about writing itself?
Well, it's because it's a journey of discovery. Every book becomes a separate journey of discovery unto its own, and it introduces me to a world I never knew. And, you know, that in itself is reason enough for me to do it. If I meet somebody like Riddick or any of these people that I've written about, the ones that I actually met, that are, you know, Stagg was a whole different thing because he kept everything in his life. You know, he and his wife, they wanted everything that they did for the world of sports to be there for future generations. So that was like going through, you know, his mind on paper. But, you know, when you're working with all these different people, you actually get a chance to walk into their world and learn things that... that really only they knew, and now they've shared it with you, and that's a wonderful opportunity to have. And what do I like most about writing? I would say it solves all the emotional pain. You know, there's five types of emotional pain: loneliness, failure, guilt, insignificance, and disrespect. And when I'm working on these different projects, I'm able to avoid all of those. And, you know, even though there's an awful lot of work involved, and there's a lot of, you know, it's stressful, and it's painful, and it's frustrating and exasperating, it still gets me away from the problems, the everyday problems that everybody has to deal with.
That's our 90-second warning.
Yeah, that's a 90-second warning. I really thank you for giving me this opportunity to, you know, to share with you.
All right.
Also, I'll learn from you.
Well, it's been great having you on, and we'll give you a minute here to just let people know where to find you and any.
Okay. Get me at Greenberg John. That's GREENBURG John at yahoo.com. They can email me there, and I'm more than happy to communicate with them.
Right. Do you have a website or anything like that?
Not yet. I've got a couple of things. I've got this book out, Stop Hurting Me, I Don't Buy It, The Secret to True Happiness, and I guess they're going to do a website on that one. But that's kind of a little bit down the road. And once I get the website up, you know, then that'll be another little thing to be involved with, so... But I really enjoyed being with
you. Well, okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
You know, you had you have a Facebook out there, too, so people can search
that.
But we're going to sign off. And until next week, thanks, everybody, for stopping by.
Okay.
See you later.
Take care.